really kind of a sort of mixture of two separate projects. So the first tale of The Scaler is work I've done with David Kasser and Jenny Trashin. And that's sort of more obviously relativistic. The second is a recent paper with Christos Charmouzis, Marco Chrysostomi, and Nikos Stergoulis. And both of them have the common theme that they're looking at scalar hair on black holes, but from an analytic perspective. So it's, as I've basically been thinking about hair on black holes for a very long time, actually more than 20 years, which is kind of scary. But trying to understand what you can do analytically. So that's really the story here, or the tale. And the context of the work I'm talking about today at least began by thinking about the effect of dark energy on black holes. So there's been sort of quite a lot of thought on this from different points of view. So people began sort of at basically about 99, I think Ted Jacobson, explored what might happen near the event horizon of a black hole. And how does the black hole interact with the scalar? And I think why it's interesting is because, of course, a black hole is a region of strong gravity. So if we can get any information of what's happening near the horizon, then ideally, you know, first of all, it tells us what happens to scalars. But if we understand well how black holes interact with scalars, it could at least give us a way of constraining some of these extended theories of gravity. So it's a challenge to do this sort of precisely, but I'm going to argue at least it's possible to get somewhere. And then finally, from a personal motivation, since I've gotten quite interested in black hole thermodynamics recently, it also provides, dark energy also provides a concrete way of varying lambda. So it's another way of exploring ideas of extended phase space and thermodynamics of black holes. So my question today is, how does a scalar affect the black hole and how far can we go analytically? So the outline, I've got two tales. The first one is about standard Einstein gravity and a standard scalar field. So that's your sort of common garden theory. And I'm going to be exploring how you do slow roll, a slowly rolling scalar with a black hole. So although this started off from a perspective of dark energy, it's actually ended up being much more in the context of inflation, or perhaps more obviously relevant in that context. And then the bit at the end is the more recent story, which is where it's like the other side of the coin. It's not Einstein gravity and it's not a standard scalar. So I'll talk about finding hair, which in a particular type of modified gravity with shift symmetric scalars. And so the difference or the new thing about this hair is that it's going to be valid for rotating black holes, and it's also finite on both horizons, both of which, or none, the previous solutions that have been presented didn't have that. So I guess I'd better start by doing my usual kind of hit down of the no hair theorems. So I still feel I have to do this because I know this is a sophisticated audience at Perimeter, but quite often when I talk about scalars on black holes, the immediate thing is, oh, but there's no hair theorems, right? So let's just remind ourselves about why they're not relevant. So our sort of standard perspective is black holes, exact solutions, have very few charges, mass, rotation, and electric charge, or magnetic charge, if you like. And so that's the idea. There aren't a lot of charges to specify our black hole. And the classic no-hair theorems went something like this. If you try to solve, here's an example of a scalar, but if you try to put a charge on a black hole, you're in essence solving some sort of Laplace or Poisson type equation. So you have to paint a scalar on a black hole background you have certain boundary conditions. You want things to fall off, let's say if this is a vacuum black hole, to vacuum at infinity. You also need things to be regular at the horizon of the black hole so that the fully coupled system makes sense. This then allows you to sort of get two asymptotic forms of your solution, and then typically you find they just don't match together. So that's the sort of general idea of the no-hair theorems in a nutshell.
If the field must go to zero asymptotically, you must be making some assumption about the form of the potential. You probably mean it's going to zero potential energy at infinity.
Yeah, zero potential energy. So, in fact, you're quite right. I was just about to come into the caveats and assumptions here. They're very, it's quite an idealized setup because this is a sort of mathematical theorem. And the typical things that are assumed, though not always, are that, for example, the space-time is static, it's vacuum or a lambda. I think this is where maybe what you were picking up on, Andrew, the convex potential, sort of that often the potential, if it's like a simple scalar, has to have certain properties. If you're sneaky enough with your potential, you can evade it. Also, if lambda is negative, you typically can weasel around this as well. And Einstein gravity, were the original classics, although some no-hair theorems were proved in some more standard theories of gravity. So this is the reason why people say a black hole has no hair. But I'm sort of saying moral is to unlearn what you've learned. Don't park that thought. Don't think black holes can't have interesting scalar field phenomena on their event horizons, because black holes typically aren't static, they're not in vacuum, and who knows what sort of properties your realistic potential might have, or your theory of gravity. So that's the sort of, that's kind of the mindset. Park your prejudices is the sort of aim of that. Okay, so tale one. So this is talking about standard Einstein gravity and a scalar field that's slowly rolling. So the picture here, this is a sort of cartoon, is that you have a black hole which has some particular mass. The scalar field slowly rolls. In this case, it's rolling from one lambda to another lambda. In the process, the black hole absorbs some scalar energy, so it grows. And of course, outside, your accelerating universe is slightly decelerating due to the fact the scalar is slow rolling. So that's the picture.
Just check the lengths of what the window is changing at whatever the boundary of your space energy is.
No, it'll become clearer.
Okay.
So that's just, that was a cartoon. Okay. My idea is that lambda is slowly rolling, the black hole is accreting. So what does it do? So at the moment, I'm not being very precise, so you'll just have to, as I say, park your prejudices and wait and see.
Yeah.
So first of all, this is a good way of trying to evade a no-hair theorem because it's clearly time dependent. Another good reason to do it is that a rolling scalar corresponds to ideas of dark energy and, of course, inflation. And the upshot, this is what I was saying, is that what we should see is we should see a growing black hole. Meanwhile, we should somehow see the cosmological constant dropping.
You're going to later tell us what we should mean by black holes.
Yeah, so. So let's just remind ourselves by what we mean by a black hole in this context. So first of all, if we just had a constant lambda, we know exactly what to do. We have the Schwarzschild de Sitter solution. So we have, it looks like the Schwarzschild solution, but we've added a lambda to it. So if our lambda is positive, we get a zero when r is near 2m and a zero when r is near roughly 1 over the root of lambda. That's just putting that in more concrete form. So here's our Schwarzschild de Sitter. if we just had, rather than an inflationary scalar, we had a sort of finite roll from a maximum to a minimum of a potential, we might expect to start off at a Schwarzschild de Sitter and to end up at a Schwarzschild de Sitter. And given that these are our sort of formulae for our horizon radii, then it's sort of clear that if we add something to M, this radius will go up. It's slightly less clear what happens to the cosmological radius because lambda's decreasing, so this bit increases, but M is increasing, so that bit also increases. So it's a little less clear what happens to the cosmological horizon, but our aim is to find an analytic description that's a good approximation to this time-dependent black hole going from one Schwarzschild de Sitter to another. So that's the aim. And what are the, you know, what? Why do we think this might be sort of tractable? Well, I've got the original Mr. Slow Roll at the back here, but in slow roll inflation, we have this notion that our lambda does indeed vary gradually. So we have our standard Friedman-Robertson-Walker equations coupled to a scalar. So these are the full equations. But again, roughly speaking, for slow roll, we assume that the motion's friction dominated, so we kind of ignore the phi double dot. And we also assume that the energy density of the universe is potential dominated, so we get something that's roughly a lambda. So our h squared looks like some expectation value of w here, and our phi dot is like w primed on h. So to keep consistency in this approximation, we have to ensure that the potential obeys certain constraints. It has to have a relatively flat derivative relative to its overall magnitude, and also it can't be too strongly curved. So these are our slow roll parameters to ensure consistency of inflation. So what happens if we try and add a black hole? Well, there's quite a few differences start to crop up. Our Schwarzschild de Sitter geometry is naturally written in these static coordinates. So what's this? How are we going to define this slow roll? So here, if we send our mass to zero in Schwarzschild de Sitter, we actually don't get anything time dependent at all, but it does have a horizon. So what's really happening is this is just this usual nuisance of different ways of, you know, writing down a space-time in GR, and de Sitter is particularly symmetric, so has rather a large number of different natural or nice coordinate systems. So this is what we call a static patch of de Sitter. De Sitter is naturally represented by a hyperboloid in a sort of one-dimension higher space-time, and so the static patch is some sort of strip of this hyperboloid. So it is representing this time-dependent space, but just in a peculiar way. And to get from our static coordinates to these more familiar cosmological coordinates, we have to just do a coordinate transformation. But it's definitely not a sort of trivial one. You see that it really mixes together, as it should, the Schwarzschild time and the Schwarzschild radius. So we've got this sort of, I mean, it doesn't look too complicated, admittedly, but it is a little bit of a sort of gnarly transformation between our cosmological and static coordinates. And of course, once we add the black hole, even this sort of relative simplicity goes out the window. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, sort of borrow some of this intuition of the slowly rolling scalar. We're going to say that our background is essentially Schwarzschild de Sitter, but with a perturbation. Our scalar is some background value plus the slowly rolling piece. And we're going to take the Einstein equations and then expand them order by order. So we're going to do perturbation theory in the Einstein equations, but what will turn out is it's not a perturbation in the normal sense of cosmology, where you're sort of looking at spatial perturbations. This is more of a time perturbation. So everything is always going to be exact in the spatial sections to that order. Okay, so that's the different thing. So the idea is our space-time slides from one Schwarzschild to sitter to another one, and we're going to track how it slides. So first of all, let's look at the scalar equation of motion. So our scalar equation of motion on our background, this is our Schwarzschild de Sitter background, has this form. If we've got time dependence, we've got phi double dot over f. And this is our spatial part of the wave operator. And then it's going to be related to dw d phi or w prime. And we want to transform this into a slow roll type of equation. And we'll do this by assuming that phi is some function of a time parameter, some time that we're going to find, where our time parameter is just t plus some radial profile. So we have to add in a radial profile because within our Schwarzschild de Sitter set of coordinates, as we go into the black hole, we know that the coordinate system breaks down. So we would have to go to either Kruskal's or local Eddington Finkelstein coordinates. And the same sort of thing happens out at the cosmological horizon. So we can't just say phi is 5t, and indeed we shouldn't expect to, given that our de Sitter space is manifestly static, and yet we know that's somehow a cosmological space-time. So that's our aim. And we construct t to make phi regular at both horizons, both future event horizons, I should be specific. So we substitute in this phi of t plus psi, and this is what our wave operator turns out to be. And so notionally, if we're doing slow roll, we say we want to ignore phi double dot. So we cross out this second term, and we're left with just the first term. And because phi is a function of t, this prefactor, which is a function of r, should be a constant. So that tells us what this psi has to be. It's some integral of these constants, beta and gamma, divided by the Schwarzschild potential. So these two constants, beta and gamma, we then fix by our boundary conditions at the event horizons. We want phi ingoing on the black hole horizon, outgoing on the cosmological horizon. We roll up our sleeves, we find out what beta and gamma are, and we get this answer for our capital T. So notice, if you sort of forget the second line, but look at the first line, we see that these kappas are the surface gravities on the event horizons, and you can sort of see this logarithmic behavior, which is what you get when you're trying to do a coordinate transformation into locally regular coordinates, the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. So near the black hole event horizon, you've got T plus R star, and near the cosmological horizon, you've sort of got T minus R star. So,
sorry, what happened to, you had one where R is squared and R, and then they have log mass, or what did you do?
Found what this was. This is our gamma's a constant, so we can integrate that up, right? Because we've got 1 over r squared, a total derivative, so we integrate up minus 3 gamma r squared. That gives us the first term. We get an integration constant, right? So the beta is an integration constant, the gamma is the slow roll constant.
So you get inside phi, and then you integrate it.
And then we integrate it up. So that's why the logs come in, because we've got the 1 over f.
Okay?
Yeah.
Just naively looking at the terms that you crossed out. So if I plug in your expression for psi prime, it badly behaves near the black hole horizon.
No, it doesn't. If you actually look, when you find what this is, because psi prime's going like 1 over f, so this thing actually, f psi prime goes to plus or minus 1.
But there is 1 over f.
That's right. So it's regular. Overall, the whole thing is regular. So f psi prime, it turns out, has to, one of the sort of conditions for this being an ingoing or outgoing mode at each horizon is that this psi prime or f times psi prime tends to either plus or minus one. So this bracket actually vanishes at each horizon. So when you divide by f, you get something finite and it's small. So yeah, we check that it's consistent. Yeah. I know it looks like it, but in fact, it sort of turns out that when you roll your sleeves up, you go through the algebra, you find the condition that phi is ingoing at the black hole horizon. I think this goes to minus one there, but I could have swapped, swapped them over. Yeah.
My question was whether you checked that.
Yeah, okay. Right. So just graphically, if I plot in T and R coordinates, what the null coordinates, so this is Zeddington Finkelstein advanced and retarded, you see that on the black hole horizon, V equals constant, which is what tells you about time on the black hole horizon. This is sort of nicely tracking T. Of course, V is not well behaved on the cosmological horizon, but U is, and of course, U tracks this T. So this capital T interpolates nicely between the relevant Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates at each future event horizon. So again, as a sketch, I emphasize this as a sketch, this idea is that T equals constant is looking something like this. It's stretching along between the future event horizons on each side. So normally, if you want to regularize Schwarzschild de Sitter, you either go to the Kruskals at the black hole horizon, which gives you these two surfaces, or you go to the cosmological horizon Kruskals, which would give you those. So this is something that's kind of in between, sort of the future regular coordinate. So given that structure, it seems a natural way, if we want to tackle back reaction, to instead go to these coordinates, this T, R, and I guess the angular coordinates go along for the ride. So this would be our Schwarzschild de Sitter metric written in the T and R coordinates that I've been derived specifically for you. But instead we say, well, no, let's just look at this form of the metric and imagine that F and H are not quite the Schwarzschild de Sitter, but something close to that. So we'll take this particular gauge, we'll calculate the energy momentum of a scalar field depending just on capital T, and we'll calculate the Einstein tensor, which is this. And then we'll see what the fully back-reacted system looks like, and then ask what is the slow roll approximation within this context. So it sort of looks a bit daunting at some sort of initial level, but it's actually not too bad. This one here is kind of the relevant one. You sort of see certain patterns that keep cropping up. Okay, so if I put in my phi equals 5t, this is what my wave equation looks like. And I've picked out that TR Einstein equation because it's the one that kind of best mirrors the Friedman equation or what's going on with the Friedman equation. So here's our sort of pair. You can see we've got a phi double dot and a phi dot. And something that looks similar to what the original wave equation in Schwarzschild de Sitter coordinates actually was. So that's the idea. We're going to start off with a background Schwarzschild de Sitter solution, and then we're going to allow it to just sort of gently relax to a new nearby Schwarzschild de Sitter solution. So if we want to do this slow roll approximation, we have to say that our geometry is potential dominated and our motion is friction dominated. So phi double dot is much less than this phi dot, and phi dot squared is much less than W. The difference here is we've got this same prefactor, which is like a slow roll relation, but now with some radial functions mixed in. So here was our original epsilon and eta. So let's look at our... I've already said that. Take each in turn. So let's look at the scalar. What's this? This first 1 minus h squared on f. Phi dot squared is much less than w. So here, this is kind of looking at the profile of what happens to, here is our slow roll parameter, if you like, a local slow roll epsilon, and this is our profile function. And so the sort of notion is that even though we've got this profile that looks like it's singular, this is f psi prime that you were asking about before, the profile or the effect of the profile on the epsilon parameter is bounded. And it turns out that as long as we take our traditional epsilon parameter to be small, then this will always be true. So although we have a radial sort of influence, a radial profile on our sort of friction. So I just realized I put it down. So what I think this is this 1 minus h squared on f. So as a function of radius. So we're going between, I've sort of normalized everything to the cosmological radius. But it's the main message is that that function is bounded. So all you're ever doing, even though it looks like you could be in trouble, all you're ever doing is multiplying the standard slow roll relation by some radial profile that actually doesn't vary that much.
Sorry for being picky. On the previous page, it looked like epsilon is larger than 1. Is that
no, this is this is the multiplicative factor.
Okay.
So it's something that's round about 1. It varies between 1, 1.5, something like that, yeah? So you're kind of, it's only changing your slow roll relation by something of order 1. I think that's the key. It doesn't change it by anything dramatic. And it's the same with the other relation for W double primed on W, where you've got this same prefactor here. And so you can work out this gives you the same, if you take the same eta parameter to be small, then this will always be small. So that's kind of looking at that other relation. So it seems like we've looked at the Einstein equations, we've looked at the scalar equation, we've asked, what's the analog of slow roll? We know if the epsilon and eta parameters are small, we've got a meaningful perturbation or way of writing down our sort of shifting de Sitter space perturbatively. So we know that everything's sort of going to be given in terms of these epsilon and eta parameters. So now that means we can find our back reacted space-time kind of order by order. So, obviously, whenever somebody says order by order, they really mean they only ever do the first one. So I'm no different. So F is this, the Newtonian, the Schwarzschild potential. So this is what it's equal to. So F changes according to phi dot squared. Now, that's what you'd expect, because although the geometry is lambda dominated, your background Schwarzschild de Sitter geometry is static. So if there's no phi dot, there shouldn't be any evolution of f. So the fact that f dot goes like phi dot squared is exactly what you would expect. It also shows that, therefore, this is like order epsilon, more or less. So we can integrate this up and find out what our f of r and t now is. So this is our original, and this is now our shift in the Schwarzschild potential. So this delta f is of order epsilon times eta, so it's actually subdominant to this final term, which is, if you like, an accretion term, because phi dot squared looks like the energy that's falling across the event horizon. So we can integrate up our phi dot squared to give us this time-dependent effect. So if we look at what phi dot squared actually is, it's something that is tracking the shift in the potential energy. And again, after a bit of work, we find that there's sort of two, it feeds into two different pieces across the space-time. It feeds into a shift in lambda and a shift in m. And I'm keeping in this delta f for the moment, but in essence, delta f is considerably less than the shift in m and the shift in lambda. So what we're finding is that as we get the scalar field kind of gently rolling, the dominant effect on our geometry is simply to make lambda and m time dependent. The only caveat is, of course, it's capital T, not the original little t of Schwarzschild. So if we look at, for example, how m changes, it's in fairly good agreement with what you would expect from a sort of order of magnitude of what happens in terms of, you know, the energy momentum tensor and the scalar field falling across the horizon. So that's our solution.
It's about the relevant time scales. So mm-hmm. homogeneous cosmology context, the slow-roll parameters are measuring how rapidly things vary relative to Hubble's time,
yeah.
which is the only time problem. Mm-hmm. Same scale factor and phi dot very slowly compared mm-hmm. to that. You effectively have two different time scales because you have two horizons.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a bit unclear whether your epsilon is still like an inflation measuring things are going slow compared to the Hubble time scale
right.
of the lambda, or if this T parameter is somehow averaging.
Okay. So there's two things kind of going on. So the first is that we define our slow roll parameters purely in terms of the potential. So they're the same, if you like. So they're cosmological-like in the sense of there's no Hubble parameter appears in there. The second thing is about the time scale, which I don't know if it comes next. Can I hold, I'm going to come jump, sort of hop back to this. Sorry, I've just got one thing just to comment going back to the question I raised right at the beginning about whether the cosmological horizon grows. In fact, on each horizon, you can integrate exactly the Einstein equations because it's sort of, I guess, because it's parabolic on the horizon or something. But we find that the horizon areas grow, and this is exactly corresponding to the local energy momentum flux times the local area. So I wanted...
This is for both horizons? Or?
Both horizons, so both grow. So I just wanted to get back to Andrew's question because it looks like the slow roll, the friction term in terms of the phi has actually changed, which seems paradoxical because the further away you get from the black hole, surely you should return to standard slow roll inflation without the black hole. So here's what our slow roll equation looks like with this T parameter. And the gamma, if I write it down explicitly, actually has quite a nice format in terms of the geometry. It's the total area of the event horizons divided by the total volume between them. So this definitely does not look like sort of the Hubble parameter. So it's not, although if you switch off the black hole, it is, it's 1 on RC. If you have a black hole, it looks very different. So what's going on? So there, what you have to do is just, again, a few sort of bits of manipulation. You need to extend beyond the event horizon, the cosmological event horizon. And so to do that, you just shift coordinates. You change We know what dt is, so we kind of concoct a radial coordinate to get rid of the gtr piece. And then we can, turns out, we can just go straight beyond the event horizon because this capital T and capital R now allow you to just cross the event horizon. So this is just looking at GTT and sort of GRR as we go through the cosmological horizon. So those are nice coordinates or natural coordinates to take us through the cosmological horizon. And once we're beyond the cosmological horizon, we can now identify what cosmological time is because this R squared, which was our original R, should be looking like, where are we? This, here, should be looking like some exponential. We should have an e to the 2ht, and we should also have a rho cosmological squared. So when I kind of do all this sort of dancing through coordinate transformations, I find that I want to identify my asymptotic cosmological time, not with t, but with a ratio h over gamma times t. So in fact, you get back to the standard slow roll equations, and it's saying this t is simply a cosmological time times a ratio. So our capital T really is asymptotically cosmological time, even though it doesn't necessarily look like it because it's this complicated, ugly expression. So that we get back to our standard slow roll. I think, although I put in some slides on black hole thermodynamics, I think I'm going to skip them. Suffice it to say that we sort of looked at black hole thermodynamics with a varying lambda and confirmed sort of we got a not just sort of a shift between initial and final states, but managed to find a sort of full differential time-dependent thermodynamic first law, and also explored things about dynamical temperature. So let me get to tail two, which is modified gravity and not a standard scalar. So this is kind of the other side of the coin. So in terms of trying to think about ways of having late-time acceleration without a lambda, the name of the game had been for some time to try to modify gravity. And one of the problems with that is how do you modify gravity in the IR without spoiling your UV or sort of mid-UV success? I think it was quite interesting, this testing gravity conference, which I know some people in the room went to. I think modified gravity, people are sort of gradually realizing this is not an easy thing to do. And so although we do have theories of modified gravity, I think they're becoming much more difficult to actually satisfy all the various constraints. So what Christos, Marco, and Nikos and I looked at was hair in this degenerate higher order scalar tensor gravity. Now, at some point, I think, I sort of start to feel life is too short for some of these theories. But, so we're looking at these theories in which, which are constrained because we know that gravitational waves have to propagate at the speed of light. So this is kind of what we're left with once we have speed of gravity, gravitational waves as one, and there's no sort of instabilities. And I am not taking any questions on well-posedness. So why is this potentially, at least, why do people are people interested in these shift symmetric theories? So the idea is this x is the gradient of the scalar field, and things only depend on the gradient. The scalar itself has no meaning. It's really just a grad phi that's cropping into things. Well, if we look for a solution in which the scalar has a constant gradient, so x equals x naught, and we ask for an Einstein metric solution so that, I think there's supposed to be an equation there, so that we solve g mu nu is equal to lambda times the metric, then these are the sort of equations we get. This is the metric Einstein equation, and this is the scalar equation. So I want to focus on this piece here, k plus 2 lambda g, because k was like a constant piece in the Lagrangian, or potentially would be constant if x were constant. So this would be like where lambda would appear. And g is something multiplying r. So what this means is that if we set this term to zero, in essence, we want both this and this piece to be zero, what we've done is we've tuned the cosmological constant. The bare cosmological constant is, if you like, this k, but it's being rescaled by the pre-multiplier of r. So, as I say, it's a bit daunting, but everything's just evaluated at a constant gradient, a constant magnitude of d phi. We get a modified cosmological constant, but we get, here we've got the same term here and here. And also, if we've got this A3 multiplying this bracket here. So if we choose x0 to be where this A3 function vanishes, we've killed that term, we've killed that term, we've tuned the cosmological constant to kill that term, and then all we're left with is this other piece. And so we are restricting the class of theories to have k, the derivative of k, plus 4 lambda times the derivative of g equal to 0 at the 0 of A3. So that's, as I say, but it's a lot going, there's usually a lot flying around with the modified gravity theories, but really what it boils down to is we want to try and find a solution for a black hole with one of these shift symmetric scalars. And in some sense, we're going to cheat. It's called stealth hair, because we paint the black hole with a scalar in such a way that the scalar doesn't back react on the geometry. So that's our challenge. And there's been quite a few of these solutions in the literature, but they are scalar rolls on the horizon, but it tends to blow up on any cosmological horizon. That doesn't matter so much, since phi itself is not actually an observable, but it made me nervous. It didn't make my collaborators quite so nervous. And it's not such a problem because of the shift symmetry. So the absolute value of the scalar is not what's sort of physically interacting with the space-time. The other thing was, of course, nobody found rotating black holes. So in essence, it's slightly sort of. So in the context of the exact symmetries and the exact solutions, it's a false statement. But if you perturb your background, then you will indeed have perturbations of the scalar, and that these will perturbatively back react. So it will change perturbation theory of the black hole, but it won't change the background solution. So that's the idea. Sorry?
So are there physical perturbation things that not considered perturbations that have no back reaction? That's what I'm...
So I don't, I mean, I'm not sure I know what, if you're asking, do these solutions, so all I'm going to present are exact solutions of rotating black holes painted with a scalar field that does not back react on the black hole in this theory of gravity. I'm making no statements about quasi-normal modes, about any sort of perturbation theory around the black hole. I'm just presenting exact solutions.
So that means perturbations can back react?
Yes.
In the background, is
like, in the background solution, the scalar does not.
Sorry. It doesn't mean like you just said two opposite things.
No, I didn't. So.
We have a background, which is exactly what perturbations, we don't know what
they're. Well, okay, then you're saying it's a perturbation theory. I think it's fine, I'm just trying to clarify which it is.
But a
zero-order
perturbation theory is a background.
keep going.
Yeah.
So this x naught parameters, it's basically the derivative of the scalar field.
Yes, the magnitude of the derivative.
So changing x naught would constitute finite energy deformation or not?
Yes.
So when you are saying that you restrict to a class of solutions where x naught is nailed to a particular value, would that be a stable statement against which relations in x naught?
Well, that's the question. So I think, so Christos seems to think that yes, but it's not necessarily true in all possible, you know, because that G function could be quite general. So it may be, it may restrict you further within your class of theories, because you've got an A3 function, you've got the G function, you know, you have all these sort of different, at the point of the Lagrangian, arbitrary functions. So I would not expect this background solution to be perturbatively stable in all of these, you know, in all of this parameter space of theories, but it may well be that there's some subset of functions of A3 or G for which it is, if that makes sense. Yep.
That would be very surprising. Based on the equation motion that you thought were printed out, mathematicians don't even have a theory to start talking about those equations. So it's very surprising. You prepare them and you can make it. There's a corner where things are going to be equal. I'm willing to kind of bet that no matter what you do, this what you're finding a solution depends on intensity.
You're getting very close to the well posed in this question. No, but yeah, so I would probably say, you know, to try and remain within, you know, so it's true, once you have the higher derivative theories, then you can always destabilize them. But the question is that going to be sort of moving to sort of moving towards a regime where your perturbation expansion breaks down?
I think that that's the case.
So you think so?
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. So I don't know. I suppose I'm slightly less sure because of stuff, you know, sort of thinking about sort of finite width expansions where it looks like you get a sort of effective action that looks badly behaved, but in reality, you know, your UV physics comes in.
Well, we have people that explore that. So here, when people do perturbations of these kind of things, they assume that the perturbation makes sense. Someone has come and proved what mathematicians call instability, which is a solution to the linear algebra problem, can be obtained by solving the full problem and taking the parameter to a small part of them. And even in GR, in cognitive cosmology, that's a very difficult question because one of us answers the very small routines. When you now talk about equation motions that have box by Q, what the hell is that? Exactly.
I think you guys need to make a bet of some sort.
Well, I come to your rescue a little bit. I mean, it is true in DRGT and DGP. Gravity that there is a finite window around solutions that is stable. They're not universally stable, even in the full nonlinear theories, right? We've tested this.
Yeah.
You could break it, but there are classes of solutions, and that's
I think it's reasonable that there can be stability with perturbative stability. What you worry, you know, kind of large amplitude deviations, and yeah, I agree with you, but
I think that it may also be there's a difference between physical and mathematical stability as well. Okie doke. So, what we wanted to do was to find a rotating black hole with this so-called stealth hair. So here is our rotating black hole metric, and it's got lots and lots going on. But the sort of key method that allows you to crack the problem of finding this stealth hair is to think about what it means to have the constant gradient. So the constant gradient of the scalar is very reminiscent of the geodesic equation. with an affinely parameterized geodesic having a unit or constant tangent vector. So we kind of thought about how can we use this to construct a scalar field. So let's use this affinely parameterized geodesic. So we know how to solve geodesics on Kerr. We get constants of motion due to the time and the axial killing vectors. And then we also have a Carter constant. So we have these three different constants, E, L, and Q. And so the idea is that we're going to identify our scalar field with a sort of the Hamilton-Jacobi potential. So this is the usual convenient way of finding geodesics. You construct some scalar potential such that the derivative of the scalar is like the momentum of the particle. So that's the idea. And then this is your scalar potential. So here is ET. So when you take the derivative, you get E, which is the constant associated with the killing vector d by dt. This is LZ, the constant associated with the phi killing vector. And then for the R and theta, this was the whole point of what Carter did in the 60s. He found that this Hamilton-Jacobi potential was separable. And here is the Q, the Carter constant, coming in terms of this R, these R and theta functions. So this would be just for an individual geodesic, but we want to somehow associate this function with phi, which is a scalar throughout the whole space-time. So that's going to give us constraints because we want our scalar gradient to be constant and smooth. And so when we look at what happens on the axis, we see that LZ has to vanish, so there's no phi dependence, and Q has to take a specific value with respect to E and M. So we're going to parameterize that by this relative energy eta, and this now reduces our parameter space down to an overall scaling little m, which is probably not very relevant. And it just sort of, well, it is relevant because it changes the length of phi. And eta, which is like a sort of relative energy. So here are our theta and r potentials. And typically, because you're taking a square root to find the scalar, you have four possible choices for the branch of this square root. So that's sort of, you know, so far that just generalizes things to rotation. But what we noticed when we were doing this is that there are certain critical values of this eta parameter. So we need to have these things being positive because we're taking the square root. So that means eta can't be bigger than one from this function. And eta also has a minimum value coming from positivity of this function. But if eta is one of those critical values, it turns out that either theta or r has a repeated root. And so when you take the square root, that means you have to change branch. So for example, if this is look at the theta potential, this contributes this theta function to our scalar field. And in general, this varies asymmetrically. So it goes from being negative at one axis to positive at the other. But if eta is one, then the natural square root to integrate is just cos, which changes sign, and that gives this much simpler looking potential. So in essence, what you do, what this would be doing is somehow taking a slightly bizarre limit of sending eta equal to one, but you're always taking the modulus of cos up here. So you can see that's kind of a discontinuous thing to do. So this gives this sort of scale profile around the black hole. So this would be the generic profile, and this is when you sort of take that eta equals one symmetric square root. So the scalar field has a sort of clear angular dependence around the black hole. So this is just a different way of trying to sketch it, where this is the horizon of the black hole, and this is like a phi equals constant surface. And of course, I've kind of subtracted off. This is in sort of Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. So both this phi is finite. More interestingly, if you look at the R function and you take the critical value of eta, then you see that you need to sort of change branch of that square root function so that you go sort of have a nice smooth square root of R. And so this now means, again, sort of harking back to the previous scalar, that phi goes like either plus or minus R star at the each horizon. So if you couldn't change sign of the square root, then phi would diverge on one or the other horizon. Now, diverging doesn't mean a physical divergence because it's shift symmetry, but it's something that's less pretty. So this is the sort of plots in a causal Penrose diagram of the phi equals constant curves. So they're now, you can sort of extend beyond the cosmological horizon in that case. So I just finishing off is comparing the modified gravity phi with the slow roll phi. Both of the phis are regular at both horizons, but the modified gravity phi is stealth. It has to have a constant gradient, whereas the slow roll phi solved the wave equation, at least approximately. So they are different scalars. And I think it's just kind of interesting how, you know, you can get these different ways of having things that are regular on both horizons. So I'm out of time, so I'm just going to summarize. In the first part of the talk, I talked about slowly rolling scalars and generalized the slow roll description to having this black hole background and looking at sort of sliding from one Schwarzschild de Sitter space to another. I didn't say, although we did explore the thermodynamics of this system, I didn't really talk about it. And I also just briefly covered this idea of stealth hair, which is, it takes a bit of getting used to these shift symmetric scalars. And I kind of knew that Luis would come up with the usual well-posedness in a different objection. But it's at least, you know, in terms of having analytic solutions, it allows you to at least explore possibilities where, you know, where you may have these, if you have some of one of these really way out different gravities, you know, what might it do to your black hole? So both of them are time dependent, both are finite at each horizon, but it's doing different things in between. So stop there. Hi, Matt.
So you picked on this particular model, but DRGT and DGT coupling limit are basically this.
With different.
With no back reaction. Looking at black hole solutions there.
So, not yet, because this is just something that actually it started off with. So Christos was Yevgeny Babichev was, you know, one of the first people to find this sort of time-dependent hair. And I think it just started off with Christos and I playing to see how general we could get. And we started off with this geodesic approach that I've presented here, but we also actually found a more general theorem, but then couldn't really find anywhere to apply it. So we never wrote that up. So you're saying your sort of DGP decoupled is, it's basically a subclass of one of these, is it? I think so, yeah, it's shift symmetric. Yeah.
It's just a subclass of that action, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Different terms in that action.
Yeah.
Is it different term or a sine term? Why does it?
Well, she picked on particular terms.
Yeah.
I'm a bit confused how different. I think that only the first term, two terms are the. So, could you just have the first two terms of that action? Or do you need more terms?
So maybe, I'm just trying to remember because it's all, you've got to make sure that like, you know, the speed of gravity is one and so that's the case.
So that's guaranteed.
I must admit, I sort of.
I was talking about the action. So it's the first two terms,
the
happen.
Yeah, so in the end, where, you know, we're looking at a zero of A3, right? And A5 is totally proportional to A3, so that drops. And A4 is, so not quite, not quite.
So there is one term left in A4, sorry.
Yeah.
Well, unless there, yeah.
Okay. So not quite, but close. Yeah.
And remind us what is necessary, but I mean, that's a stratigraphy.
Yeah, so this is to try and avoid sort of this bit is speed of light, speed of gravity one, and this bit is are avoiding the instabilities.
So if I set A4 to 1, then are you saying there's a stratigraphic instability? I said A4 to 0, sorry. Yeah. Because I thought the ordinary DGP.
No, these A4 and A5 are constrained not to have the instabilities. If we set A3 to 0, A5 is 0. At a 0 of A3, though, A4 is not necessarily 0. So I think all, I mean, you were saying, can't we just take the first two terms?
Yeah.
And I'm saying, well, maybe not, actually.
Okay, but then that would suggest that the decoupler DGP does have a stochastic.
What does that?
Yeah.
Well, unless it's.
It's related, but there is not a precise one to one.
Yeah, so there's not precise. Yeah, I think it would take a bit of digging into. Yeah.
You presented this very much as a mathematical result, but at least the slow roll bit of it is quite plausibly applicable to the real universe. If the test is right, your solution is then supposedly the correct solution for galactic center black hole, for example. So that begs the question of whether there is any in principle observational signature associated to your solution, or whether in practice the time scales are all so fantastically long
So I think in the current day, the timescales are indeed fantastically long. So the only way I could sort of see this imprint is where the variation of the black hole horizon is significant, at least on the cosmological timescale, which would be set more by the cosmological horizon. And so that would only be in the very early universe with a sort of significant sized black hole. So, but that's the effect of this with the rolling scalar is really slow compared to that timescale. So I'm not sure I see what it might have as a late time observational consequence, but it's a different matter in terms of if there were primordial black holes that were present during inflation, then this gives at least a way of actually saying, well, you know, this would be the imprint on them. I mean, I know you've got cosmological perturbation theory, but I guess that would be the only way I could imagine an possible imprint on the CMB.
Yeah, it's in principle different, and you might particularly think of theories that unify inflation and contestants, like the Lenkin.
Like what, sorry?
The scenarios about the Lenkin and someone forgotten who make the inflation field become the quintessence field in the late universe.
Right.
So it's permanently there.
Mm-hmm.
So that might then have some long lasting cumulative effect through the entire cosmic history from the variation of the scale of the field.
Yeah, I mean, so we do see that the scalar is dragged, if you like, by the black hole horizon. But
I'm assuming more is to do with the possible accretion of mass by the black hole on the scalar.
Yeah.
Maybe some consequence. What it is, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, at least we can track what happens to the accretion of the black hole. So we could, so we would know, at least to some level, how much the black hole might grow during the inflationary process. So, but I think you know way more about, you know, the formation of primordial black holes than
I do. In a normal scenario, primordial black holes will only form some substantial time after.
After inflation, yeah. Yeah.
Perturbations created during inflation, later re-entry yeah. horizon. So that's why I was thinking a theory where the inflationary scalar field is somehow long-lived, so it has to become the dark energy or become the dark matter in some universe.
Well, or if there was some freak occurrence so that there was a black hole, at least in one, you know, somewhere in the universe during inflation, because we always sort of, you know, assume that we start out with a, you know, a sort of not too complicated space to enter inflation, then, you know, this would at least give a possible way of exploring what that would, how that would impact, whether there would be a, you know, a long-range effect or what that would be beyond just standard perturbation theory.
All right, let's thank you again for your time.